Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last November, Mo Green was elected North Carolina's Superintendent of Public Instruction. He replaced Republican Catherine Truitt in that job, but ran against the Republican who beat Truitt in the primary, Michelle Morrow. Morrow was a controversial candidate who homeschooled her six children and called the state's public schools politically biased, racially divisive, sexually explicit, and academically weak. She characterized teachers as groomers and our schools as indoctrination centers. Voters rejected her message and elected Green, who spent 7 years at the helm of the state's third largest public school system in Guilford County. Just months into the job, Mo Green has been listening to parents and teachers and students as part of his Mo Wants to Know tour, but he faces some of the same challenges that his predecessor did. Public schools struggling with funding, struggling to get students to read, write, and do math at grade level, and now possible cuts from Washington as the Trump administration dismantles the Department of Education. We spend time this hour talking about all of that with Mo Green. Mr. Green, welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
You are a lawyer. You ran, as I said, successfully. You successfully ran the Guilford County school system for 7 years. You have lots of kudos to your credit from that experience. Running the schools is about bringing the best educational experience to parents, teachers, and students that is possible. But in your office, your race for the office was entangled in politics, and I'm wondering why you think you won.
So certainly I do think that we were able to get our message out about vision for North Carolina public schools. We were able to focus on experiences that I had in working with and helping to improve public schools. And I believe that those two things in particular were able to help me be successful in the campaign. I also think that I also must say that it was also important for us to get out a message about who my opponent was and what her positions were as well, and so that folks had a very clear choice about who to select for their North Carolina superintendent in public instruction. And given that clear choice, obviously folks in the majority chose me.
As I understand it, you ran for this position because Governor Cooper asked you to. And when you said yes, you were planning to run against your predecessor, Catherine Truitt, who's kind of a moderate Republican. She had experience. She had vision. She was a bipartisan figure, but she lost in her own Republican primary to the person you ultimately ran against. Would you have won against Catherine Truitt, do you think?
Have no idea. These races, the statewide races in North Carolina, are typically very close. Some would say that it is actually slightly a more Republican-leaning state on these statewide races. And so running as a Democrat, you have to sort of overcome that. I certainly believe that it would have been a very close race, but whether I would have won, I have no idea.
Yeah. You won by a very narrow margin. There was a clear difference between you and your opponent in this race. I don't think it could have been clearer. It was a stark difference, but you won by 51%. What does the margin of victory tell you? How does it inform what you want to do going forward?
So number one, it confirms what my consultants had shared with me going into the race, that this was going to be a very close race, as were other Council of State races as well. Really, the only one that was really a wide margin was the governor's race, and that was because the person running against Josh Stein had his own challenge and issues. Right. So it confirmed that, number one. Number two, I certainly think that as I look forward, it does to me suggest that folks do want to have a clear, strong vision for strong public schools, and that we also need to be sure that we're dealing with issues that my opponent lifted up as well. And so we cannot overlook some of the things that she may have raised in her campaign, but I think that the vote is ultimately decided. While working on those issues, let's be sure that we also think about how we have a very strong, positive message about our public
I
schools.
guess what I was getting at with the 51% to 48 point something percent margin of victory is that 51% decided that your prescription for the what's wrong or what's right with the public schools, for that matter, was the way to go, but a big bunch of people thought the other way was the way to go. So in that situation, what do you do? I mean, how do you reconcile that in your head? Because the two visions are starkly different.
Yeah, so in my mind, I focus on the vision that I put forward. It is a vision that I've said before, achieving educational excellence, which includes improving academic performance, and certainly also focuses on character development. And then finally on us, and I've not been bashful in saying I do believe that we can have the very best public education system in the entire country here in North Carolina. What that does also do, though, is it does recognize some of the issues that my opponent was lifting up. Yeah, so for example, she lifted up the need for us to have safe and secure learning environments. Her way of talking about it was perhaps different than the way I would have talked about it. But at the end, I do think that parents and community members want to be sure that we're focused on that issue. So that will be part of what we push forward as well.
Given the challenges that you face with lack of funding, et cetera, historically, at least in North Carolina, why do you think we can have the best public school system in the country?
Yeah, so I do believe that we have lots of really good things already in place. We have to build on those, galvanize public school champions to help us get more funding so we can do more. Let me talk about a few of those things just so folks have a sense, because oftentimes what is reported may not be all of the good that's already exists, right? So our graduation rate, 4-year cohort graduation rate, has been steadily increasing here in North Carolina into the mid to high 80s at this point of students graduating on time. At the same time, we've increased the number of students who have earned industry recognized credentials. We've had more students than ever taken past college level courses or exams while still in high school, and foresee those continuing. Our dual enrollment opportunities have expanded pretty dramatically. And so, yeah, there are lots of good things that are going on, even while we do recognize there are things for us to work on. And so I think, as opposed to some situations where you're starting with an extreme deficit problems and you say, well, gosh, if we can just get a little bit better, that would be progress. I think we're at a different place. My evaluation is we're at a different place. So why don't we now take where we are and really strive to be the absolute best in the country?
Your predecessor, Catherine Truitt, focused or emphasized career readiness for students. She focused on teacher recruitment and retention, which is a problem given the salary levels throughout the state. And she did so, she guided that system through the COVID pandemic, which was, through no fault of her own, it badly damaged education and learning levels. What will your focus be as superintendent? How will your approach be different?
Yeah, so just for a matter of context, we will be working with the State Board of Education to put out a strategic plan, the first draft of which will be shared in early June at the June meeting of the State Board of Education. So some of what I'm going to say today will have to wait for it actually to be put out. But I have indicated what certainly I believe our vision should be, which is that academic achievement, and also character development as well. Within both of those, I think you can hear clear instances of things like some of the things that even Catherine Truett lifted up: career readiness, improving outcomes in early grades with regards to literacy and mathematics. There will also be some things that perhaps were not in her main items that will be things that we will be lifting up. I think we are at a place where we have to recognize that public education is in a stiff competition for its existence in many ways. And so we need to be clear about the fact that we, I think, offer a tremendous choice for parents. And so how we talk about that will be important as well. How we rally folks around public education, I think, will be also important as we focus on things like academics and like character development. So that will be something that will be, I think, likely different of a focus for my administration.
So WUNC's Liz Schlemmer wrote an article about you earlier this year in which she spoke about a young man named Jose Oliva who met you when he was 15. And if I've got this correct, you are still in touch with him. You remain friends. He remembered you as a student in that job as being patient and as someone who was willing to listen. And he told Liz that you, quote, wanted to hear what students had to say. And now you are out conducting this Mo Wants to Know tour. I think it just finished up, but you've been going throughout the state, listening to people. What do you want to know?
So I wanted to know a number of things from folks throughout the state, and I sort of phrased it, put it into essentially four questions that I would pose. Yeah, so those questions were: what should we celebrate and continue in our public schools? What are the challenges and potential solutions to those challenges that face our public schools? What are your big ideas for North Carolina public schools? And then finally, what are your commitments for actions that you might take to enhance our North Carolina public schools? And so that's what I wanted to know. Those were the questions that I was posing, and I did that with parents, with educators, with students, with various groups all across the state of North Carolina, both in person, virtually, had sessions, big sessions, and we divided the state into eight regions and had conversations there. Had the same questions posed to the State Board of Education, invited members of the General Assembly to have conversations with me as well. So the questions were all this. I would pose essentially those questions each time. That's what I wanted to know.
I'm going to find out what you heard in a second, but did what you hear vary greatly from region to region, or was there a running theme? I only have about 30 seconds. Was there a running theme?
Certainly, there were things that I would say were similar across the regions. Things like focusing on funding issues, certainly being sure that we elevate our level of respect for our public school educators. There were certainly themes that resonated or came up throughout.
When we come back, I want to find out some of the things you did hear, and then how you work that into your own vision for the schools. Because I guess sometimes you might have heard things that you didn't think of or didn't plan to do. We'll get to that when we continue our conversation with Mo Green right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Mo Green, who is the North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction. It's our first conversation since he won election to that post and took office in late December, early January. And he's been on this Mo Wants to Know tour of the state, listening to parents and educators and students about what they would like to see in our public schools. Did anything stick out at you that you hadn't considered that surprised you in any way?
I don't know that there was anything that was a complete and utter surprise. There were certainly ways that folks may have approached a thought that would have been maybe different than a different way of sort of thinking about some of the things that that were not new, but sort of new angles on them. And so that was good to hear. Certainly causes one to think about issues differently, perhaps. You know, so I'll give an example. I was talking with students earlier this week and was talking about how do we recruit more young people to go into, the profession of education. Right. And certainly lots of folks talked about money and raising the compensation levels. But what really came out, again, not new, but maybe new to hear it from them, is that the best recruiters are actually our current educators, and they need to be talking more about what inspired them to become educators and why it's such a wonderful profession, rather than lifting up, as my sense is all of the concerns and negativity around public education. They have this wonderful ability to talk about all of the great reasons you ought to think about becoming an educator. So again, not new, but something for us to then sort of work with.
When you go out and you ask people what they think and you ask people what they want and what they expect out of the public schools, and then you don't do everything that they tell you, there is a risk that they feel that they have been dissed or that they have not been listened to. And that leaves an even worse taste in their mouth, perhaps, than what they had prior. What's the risk there? How do you balance what you heard with what you think the priorities ought to be?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is important is to first appreciate that people actually appreciate being heard. In and of itself, that I think is important and different than the way most people approach these sorts of opportunities. Because unlike many folks who come in and say, well, I know the answers, and here's what we're going to do, I think people very much appreciate the fact that I was willing to listen to them. Second, I think folks will see that maybe not every specific idea that they brought up is going to be in the strategic plan. There's no way that that would be possible. And I think people knew that. But I think what people will see is that there is a clear direction, that there are pillars, that there are some initiatives that perhaps did come from them, and will feel good about that. And then third, as you heard in one of the questions that I posed to folks, is, well, what are you going to do to be supportive of our public schools, right? What are your actions? And so even if what they may have put forward wasn't exactly heard, I hope that they will then say, well, I still want to get behind this because I can see a clear, positive vision, and I want to be a part of that as well. So I'm not worried about whatever risk that you think might exist. I don't feel like there is much risk at all.
One of the reasons, I suppose, that you might have been successful in Guilford County as superintendent of their schools is because of not your background in education, but your respect for the profession and for teachers. Your mother was a teacher. She instilled in you that respect for teachers and for education. And you said many times while campaigning that you, quote, revere educators. Do politicians, do parents?
Do they revere educators? Is that your question? So
yes.
I certainly think that a lot do. I do think that over the last, 20 plus years, has been a concerted effort to maybe diminish the level of respect of our educators. And so in the atmosphere, you'll hear a lot of rhetoric around educators not being respected and even revered as maybe they used to be. But I think there are a lot that still do. And my goal is to be sure that we get back to a place where we do revere educators, that we do recognize that this is a noble profession, that we do appreciate that these are the individuals that actually transforms lives, communities, families, our state, our economy. And so we ought to very much revere them. That doesn't mean that every person is perfect and that we shouldn't raise concerns. That's true in every profession, but we ought to do it in the context of these folks are doing remarkable work. Oftentimes, in hours of the day and evenings that folks don't even see, and without the kind of resources that they should have, to be sure that our next generations get what they need to be successful.
Schools in this state, and in fact across the nation, seem to be struggling with getting children ready to be able to read and do math at grade level. And I've read things that have been written by high school graduates that I just look at and think, did they go to school? And I know that's an anecdotal situation, but I've seen it many times, so I know it's true. How is it possible? Why are we experiencing this? How can a high school graduate not write?
Yeah, so I think what we need to do, number one, is really lean in on what even my predecessor leaned in on, and that is to be sure that in those early grades, we're teaching those early literacy skills and that we're very much doing it in a systematic manner. Right. Not leaving as much to sort of chance, if you will, in the way that we teach reading. I think the same thing then is true with being sure that we really get our students to write and write a lot. Do that not only then in the early grades, but even as we move along, right, in their educational journey. So that we don't have as many students who are not reading and writing at grade level by the time, particularly by the time they leave elementary school going into middle school, right? You can always continue to refine and improve as you get into middle school and into high school, but you ought to have a strong foundation by the time you're going into middle school.
Let's talk about Catherine Truett for just a second again. Your predecessor said that we have in the state a diploma integrity problem because students with low proficiency rates on state exams were still being allowed to walk away with a high school diploma. Do you agree with her on that? Do we have a diploma integrity problem? And if we do, how do you fix it?
Yeah, so I think that's probably a bit of an overstatement. Okay. I do think that there are certainly students who are not performing as well as we would want them to on particular exams when they are leaving high school. But I don't want to suggest in any way that our students are not ready for the next. Most of them are. Right. And so as I look at, the sorts of things that would suggest that, you have to go back to Certainly, how students are performing on end of grade and end of course exams, and certainly there's room for improvement. But I don't want to suggest that things are so pitiful or so off that we cannot actually lift up the many, many students who are performing exceedingly well when they graduate from high school.
During your time in Guilford County Schools, you were credited for raising graduation rates, and more importantly, I'll bet you, the number of students passing college-level courses. So, what's the secret sauce?
So I think the number one thing is to be sure, number one, that you have high expectations for each and every student. And that's easy to say, maybe harder to really sort of drill into an organization, right? But the way I think about it is this. I ask the question, why can't every one of our students, when they graduate from high school, take and pass a college-level course while they're still in high school? Take a career in technical education course and while still in high school, right? Why can't that be the case? And if that then sets the expectation, then folks start to say, okay, maybe I was thinking about this differently because I was thinking about trying to be sure that maybe students did one or the other. But once you start saying this is for every student, you start to have more folks figuring out, well, what are the barriers that are allowing us not to have that happen? How do we remove those barriers? How do we provide more access to opportunities? And it's one of those things that happens, Mike, is that things then start spiraling up, right? Because as more students get involved in higher level classes, more students get involved. They start to see their friends doing it. Our educators start to see, well, maybe something was possible that maybe I didn't realize was possible. There are strategies that are incorporated therein to support those that might need more support. Things start spiraling up in really magnificent ways. And so that's what you've seen in Guilford County Schools and now are starting to see across the state as well.
When you decided to run at the behest of the former governor Roy Cooper, your campaign was going to be about improving the schools. And then when you were faced with a different challenger than anticipated, it became about saving the public schools. And there has been a decline in trust in the public schools, some of it driven by politics. Is that because if there is a decline in trust, is it because that public schools are being asked to do too much, things that have nothing to do with education, so they've taken the eye off the ball of education? Is it because they're simply not able to serve everyone equally well? Is it because of issues outside the classroom, in the neighborhood, in the home? Is it due to lack of funding? Where does the problem lie?
Yeah, so first of all, let me just say that when I first decided to run, I was also concerned not only with improving academic outcomes and focusing on character development, but I actually, even at that point, was deeply concerned about where schools were positioned with regards to whether people believed in our public schools and were supportive of our public schools. So that was true even at the outset. It certainly got amplified when we got to the and through the primary, right? But I don't want to suggest that that wasn't already a focus of mine. Secondly, are our schools being asked to do too much? Yes and no. So I certainly think that our schools are asked to do quite a bit, but the reason that they're asked to do quite a bit is because of who comes into our school buildings, right? So we have exceedingly diverse students who come with all sorts of backgrounds, both language differences, economic differences, societal differences, and we're trying to educate them all. Right, to get them to this place where when they do cross that graduation line that they have and are equipped for whatever's next in their lives. And so if we sort of recognize that, it's hard then not to say, well, I need to be sure we're providing meals for students so that they can be successful in the classroom. I want to be sure that we provide supports for students that may not have English as their first language so that they can be successful in the classroom, and on and on and on. And so, yes, there's lots asked of educators and our public schools, but it's really the result, I believe, of the types of students that are coming into our schools today.
Public education, which has to accept everybody, faces significant headwinds, many of which we've talked about. And one of those headwinds, obviously, is the lack of funding, the need for teacher salaries to be competitive and livable, which many are not because they can't afford to live many times in the cities in which they teach. They have to live way out. The state legislature in North Carolina has been judged to have chronically underfunded the public schools, and yet they find money to give to charter schools and to funnel to these opportunity scholarships. These vouchers will now siphon off money that would have gone to the public school system, and it will also siphon students away from the public school system. They're being positioned as giving parents and students a choice in schools and taking away the burden of having them to attend poorly performing schools, which may in fact be true. But is that the motivation? Or, in your opinion, is this part of a campaign by Republicans to undermine public education?
Well, certainly, I do believe that they are making policy decisions that are negatively impacting our public schools. So let me just unpack that for just a moment. And as I do so, I do want to be clear that our charter schools are also public schools, right? So
But they're
let's
paid for
not
by the
so.
public, they're paid for by the public schools, and they operate on a different playing field with different rules.
Yes, but I don't want folks to walk away from here saying that they're not also public schools, because they are. And as we're then having the conversation, we might say that there are certainly different types of public schools, but they are part of the public schools, as opposed to the vouchers, which are allowing individuals to go to private schools with taxpayer dollars. And so I do think that that is having a very negative impact on our public schools, because you are talking about significant amount of resources going from public schools to these private schools that do not have to accept everything.
Mo Green is the North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction. We have a lot more to talk about, and we'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Mo Green, the North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction, is our guest this hour. We were talking about a lack of funding and funds being siphoned off from the public schools to fund these opportunity scholarships, which will further burden schools with insufficient resources. And one of those insufficient resources historically has been low teacher salaries. We rank near the bottom of the heap in North Carolina in terms of teacher salaries nationwide, and it makes it very difficult to attract people to the profession, to these districts, and to retain them once they're here, particularly in urban areas where the cost of living is higher. What would, in your mind, adequate compensation for teachers be?
Yeah, so wonderful question. And I certainly think that we have to have a starting, so beginning teachers, that number needs to be easily in the 50,000 plus range across the state before whatever local supplements would be added to that. Local supplements being those that then a place like a Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools or Wake County that may have, higher costs of living can add to make sure that that is a reasonable compensation for them. And then we need to go up from there, right, and have substantial steady increases from there, depending on experience, performance, et cetera. And so I do think that we are well off of that because we are barely over $40,000 as a beginning teacher compensation in that come as sort of the base compensation coming from teaching from the General Assembly. So lots of room for significant improvement on compensation.
As anybody will tell you, and they're right, money is not the answer to every problem, and throwing more money at a problem doesn't necessarily solve it. So I'm curious to know if you think adequate teacher compensation, if we were able to achieve that throughout the state, would that result in higher test scores, in graduation rates improving, in people leaving the schools adequately prepared?
I do think that it would, and I think so for a number of reasons. One is once you set a much higher compensation level, you also then begin to recruit individuals who might actually be interested in doing this, who choose other professions because they say, I cannot afford to live on the compensation that I'm would be receiving as a teacher. So the quality of the profession will improve, which I think then, as I say earlier, when things start spiraling up, other things spiral up. And so then those who are already in the profession will feel more appreciated. They will also then want to grow in their own ways as well. And so all of that then I think will positively impact our students. We'll retain, I think, at a higher level when because you're going to always lose some folks, right? But I think you'll lose less people to other professions when they say, well, I'm not going to leave just because the compensation isn't good enough. There may be other reasons that you want to go somewhere else, but that at least you take that out of the equation, for most folks.
This is the first year that North Carolina has completed rolling out the Letters training program, LETRS, which is a professional development program aimed at helping teachers understand the science of reading. Some metrics suggest that our state has been relatively stagnant when it comes to try to catch students up on reading post-pandemic. Do you think the program has been successful in improving reading outcomes, and what else needs to be done if we really want to move that needle?
Yeah, so I certainly think that the early returns on the letters training has been positive. If you look at some of the diagnostic exams that are given, those early literacy skills are certainly showing progress for our students in the early grades compared even to the rest of the nation. Who take those same types of assessments. So I do think that there is good things happening there. Now, I do think that there is still significant room to grow, particularly as we move from those early literacy skills to more sort of incorporating comprehension. And that's where I think there is going to need to be additional strategies implemented so that students can go from not only just being able to read the words, but actually understand them. And because that's what the exams that are given, like in third grade and beyond, or the national assessment is as much about comprehending what you're reading as opposed to just simply being able to read what's before you.
So, what will the empirical data be to judge the success or failure of the Letters program? Will the end of grade reading tests this year, will they be an important benchmark for judging the success of this?
So I think they are a important benchmark, but not the sole benchmarks that we should be looking at. Again, I do think that the letters training is as much about helping us get on the students on the right path with things like phonics and phonemic awareness, getting fluency to a higher level for our students. But that, and so that's good, right? And so end of grade you may or may not see that show up in an end of grade examination. And so I wouldn't want folks to simply say, well, let's do away with it. This didn't work. On to the next strategy. I don't think that's the way forward. What I do think is then we ought to be utilizing those results that we do get on end of grades to say, okay, now what do we need to be sure we're braiding into what we're teaching to be sure that we're now lifting up vocabulary and comprehension if we find that there are deficits there.
The Republican-controlled General Assembly has been working hard to diminish the power of the governor and other members of the executive branch. They've limited the attorney general, or tried to, in terms of what he can do. Both of those offices are held by Democrats. You are a Democrat, and your powers, as I understand it, have also been reduced. Lawmakers have given final authority over many of the decisions in education to the State Board of Education, leaving your office primarily responsible for implementing policies, as I understand it at least, rather than creating these policies. They have restricted your ability to hire and manage your own staff. Your position no longer has voting power on the Board of Education. Have they effectively neutered you? Is this the job you ran for?
So, first of all, that some of what you've outlined actually may need to be refined a bit. So, in the North Carolina Constitution, it is already the position of the State Board of Education to establish the policies for North Carolina public schools, and it is then the state superintendent's position to be the chief administrative officer to administer those policies. So I would just refine part of what you've said. Now, are there things that, yes, have been reduced both before I came into office and seemingly more, that folks want to do? I do think that that is happening, and I think it's unfortunate that it is happening. I would certainly say that as far as trying to, if you're running a major operation like the Department of Public Instruction and overseeing our public schools, we need to have you need to have the person who is elected to do that have the freedom and authority to actually do that. I don't need partners deciding, whether I can have this or that person or position. In order to effectively carry out the policies of the State Board and the laws of the General Assembly, allow me as a CEO to do that. And if I'm not successful, by gosh, if I decided to run again, the voters would say, we need someone else to be the CEO.
Do you have that power to do your
I
job?
don't believe that I fully have that power, no. And that predates me and continues even today. I think there are significant things that are limiting, and I think it's unfortunate because then it makes it more challenging to be the leader, the administrative leader for one of the, if not the most important organization or entity in state government.
Let's talk about another headwind. The Trump administration has severely curtailed the Federal Department of Education. They were not policymakers, despite public opinion or public thought about this. They've not been making policy for the local school districts around the country. They have been funding mechanisms for those school districts for the most part. And because of staff cuts and funding cuts at that level, they are going to impinge on your ability to fund certain things. They've shifted some responsibilities and oversight functions to other departments in the government away from the Department of Education. And Donald Trump plans to shutter the Department of Education, shut it down completely. What do you see as the end result of all these moves?
Yeah, so, first of all, I think some of these things are still in process, and so it's hard to say for certain where we'll be at the end of the day. So, for example, this idea of shuttering or dismantling the U.S. Department of Education, I think the Trump administration certainly has said, and certainly Congress has said, that it actually takes an act of Congress to actually close the U.S. Department of Education. Now, what we have seen is things that are suggesting that we're on that path. They've reduced the staffing levels dramatically within the U.S. Department of Education. But for me, what becomes critically important is really less about the magnitude of the U.S. Department of Education, the number of employees there, as opposed to the dollars that they administer. Are the dollars still going to come to North Carolina? For us, it's over $1 billion annually for our public education system. And so that's what's important. And we're already starting to see some reductions of dollars that come to states, right? So there have been cuts to various grants. For example, a lot of teacher recruitment and retention grants have re been reduced. There have been grants that have been cut for things like mental health. And so you start to see those things happening, and that's where I get terribly concerned about where we're headed. Because if the dollars get dramatically reduced, that's where we'll have significant problems providing the educational opportunities for our students, and in many instances, our most vulnerable students. Because the biggest pots of dollars that come from the federal government really cover exceptional children and students that attend high poverty schools. So that's where I would be deeply concerned about where we're headed.
Trump has also ended DEI in all federal departments, and he's taken significant steps to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in schools across the country. He's ordered a loss of funding for schools that do not comply. His policies have eliminated race-conscious scholarships and financial aid. They have reversed Obama-era changes to school discipline policies aimed at reducing racial disparities in terms of how students are disciplined or even suspended. What do you believe the impact on that will be, of that will be on our schools, and more importantly, on the students in your schools?
Yeah, so I certainly think that there is the potential to have a very negative impact on our students and their educational opportunities if we simply say we're going to do away with this sort of global concept of anything that suggests or involves diversity, equity, and inclusion. We should, and I absolutely am on board with not having inappropriate or illegal discrimination based on things like race. But to suggest that everything that is or has some connection to diversity, equity, and inclusion should go away, I think does a disservice for what we're trying to do in public education. And if that happens, I do think that that is a significant problem. You start to think about what is public education, but here in North Carolina, we have a exceedingly diverse student body, right? Racially, economically, language acquisition, many, many things, very diverse. We try to include every student in educational opportunities, regardless of their backgrounds. And by gosh, the way we do it is we say, regardless of where you are, we are going to provide you with what you need to be successful. That is equity, if I've ever heard it, right? And everyone doesn't get exactly the same things. And so you cannot, I think, simply say, we're going to do away with DEI and think that that won't have a negative overall impact on what we're trying to do in public education.
I have about a minute left. There have also been numerous policy initiatives in the Trump administration by Trump officials following the Project 2025 playbook to change what is taught and how it is taught, particularly when it comes to American history. Some say there are attempts to literally whitewash history and remove anything that might make white students uncomfortable or put America in a less than admirable light. Has that filtered down? How concerned are you about those moves?
So I'm certainly concerned. I think we need to be teaching accurate history as best as we know it. And accurate history, U.S. history, certainly includes lots of things to be proud of. But they also include things that we should not be necessarily proud of, but they're accurate and it did happen. Our students must learn both.
And finally, there was an arrest this week at a near a CMS school by a person delivering a child to that school by ICE. And the school, what should the school systems around the state's position be on activities like that, arresting a person while they're delivering a child to school? I have 20 seconds.
Yeah, so certainly we have to work with our law enforcement agencies, but we've also tried to encourage our school districts to be sure that they know what the laws are and what is permissible and not.
Mo Green is the North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.